I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that out loud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of how to not have trash politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Scene, the podcast.
Lala, it's always great to be in space with you virtually. I miss you. I want to be where you are.
I know we were supposed to see each other in person and then it didn't end up happening. So we're overdue.
I know. Soon come. But yeah. Like also let's schedule something because I feel like that's the only way that that's the only way.
Yeah, we have to like make it happen. Unfortunately, we're not young
frolicking
kids in the pre-pandemic times where you just happen to see each other.
We never like crossed paths like unintentionally, but it was a way more whimsical experience, and now I think it has to be intentional or it's not gonna happen. So we're back again with another episode, and today we're going to talk about, or the question rather that I want to pose, because I usually have a lot of questions just in my life. I never struggle to have questions. And one of the things that I have been trying to come back to, or return to, especially as we build off like last episode where I described, you know, my wish for myself being contentedness, is like thinking about what are the things that have brought me where I am. And what are the, you know, tools or the resources or the frameworks or whatever that have like built me into who I am today? So the question that I have for you following that train of thought is, who or what has been your biggest teaching or teacher in your life? And that's kind of a profoundly large question. I have like very small, even anecdotal little bits. And I'm not sure if you want to go first or if you want me to go first, because your eyes got large and I'm wondering.
Just because the way you phrased it this time, we talked about this before, but you said the biggest.
Oh, okay. Well, that's also.
And I thought, choosing just one, what is the biggest? That felt really big.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean.
It is big. It's the biggest.
Literally. The biggest. Nothing could be bigger by definition. You know
what
I mean?
Superlatives is what we're calling the easiest. But I want to start off if you're okay with it. So both of the lessons or both of the teachings, I guess, come from my mom. I was trying to find like a beautiful quote to sort of frame where I'm coming from, or like my perspective, because my mom's been like a really massive influence in my life. I'm sure I've talked about her many times. And I have a lot of like love and reverence for her. One of the things that she taught me early on in life was, when you do something wrong, when you hurt somebody, you don't get to decide if the issue is over. When you apologize to someone, you know, you basically extend that apology and you hope that that person forgives you or that person accepts it, but you can't get mad when, you know, you've done the harm and then that person is still upset with you. You got to let people be. And she never said, you know, she didn't like tell me that lesson like one time, one way. It was just watching her give us space, especially as like kids with my siblings and my sisters, like when we would get into arguments or when we would like be in our big emotions and it'd be like finger pointing time and everyone's upset and whatever. And she'd always just be like, you don't get to get mad at your sister for like her telling you that you've hurt her. That's not okay. That teaching, or I guess just like that ethos of giving people the space to have feelings, I don't even know if she knew how much that affected me, but as a very like sensitive person, as a kid who was told she was sensitive, as a kid who had just like big fucking emotions, that stuck with me profoundly. It's given me at least a starting point or a framework to like be more accepting of my own emotions. And I've never even told her, like, as a kid, when you had said those things or when you had kind of given us that space to have feelings, because she never placed them. Like, she never, my dad was more that person. And maybe my mom's teaching was a response to that, perhaps. But I've never told her about that. And yet it sticks with me the most because I think so much of my life has been shaped by at least trying to like wrestle with my feelings, or at least try to like give people the space to show up with their feelings. And I feel like that's part of my own path and journey professionally, but also like as a person on this earth, to like give people that space to have their feelings.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear you talk about where you learned that from, because that feels like such a huge part of who you are to me. You know, the way that you have such a deep respect for other people's feelings and process, and it does feel like such a huge part of the friend you are and just the community member you are, the person that you are in the world, that you have that space and feel so strongly about and deeply about, you know, people's right to have that space. So I'm wondering, you know, you said she taught you that over time and in different ways. I'm curious about, are there times where you felt it sink in more, or like where you kind of got older and felt like, oh, now I understand it on a different level than I did? Or was it something that really like immediately as a kid you took to?
I didn't take, that's a really good question. I don't think that, no, when I was a kid, I think I battled my feelings more than I accepted them. I don't even think that I, as much as I just describe myself as like, you know, really sensitive and like the sensitive one in my family, I think that the way that I expressed my emotions as a kid to my family was a fraction of what I was feeling internally. And I still felt like maybe it was that as I've gotten older, I've grown to accept my feelings. But when I was younger, it was more about how I related to other people and their feelings. And so like, especially around when you've done something that's going to elicit a response from someone, if they're upset with you, that you have to like sit with that. That's an important thing. But I don't know if I had the awareness of like turning it inward and being like, I get to sit with my feelings. Cause that's not what my mom taught me. I watched her sit with her feelings. So maybe retrospectively, like I can think about that now thinking, okay, she is like a fiery Aries and she is the kind of person who's like, when she's upset, you know, and she pops off. And she used to be a lot more, I don't know what the word is. She just changed in her, like her motherhood is, the way that she mothers has changed over time, especially when I watch her with my youngest sister. But I remember when she was, when I was younger and when she was younger, obviously too, she would, when she was upset, she was upset. Like she would like be visibly angry and maybe she would like raise her voice. But once that was done, once she processed that, it was over. And I never got that. I was always the one holding on to, I needed space and time to like process the feelings that came up if she got upset with me or something like that. I've always been that person that needs time. So when you just said before, like you've always been a person who's given people the space to have their process, I'm like, it's because I'm a process person. Like I can't do things live. Like I have to sit with it, because I also know that if I say things live, I don't know how kind I'm going to be like sometimes. So it's felt like it's a retrospective learning as opposed to something that really sunk in, because I don't even know if my mom knew that when she was saying that, she was showing me in her own behavior, but she wasn't telling me that this is supposed to be about you accepting your feelings. It's about accepting other people's feelings and other people's like natural responses to when you harm them.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think we talk all the time about how much easier it is to apply teachings to other people than to ourselves. And you in particular, there's been a lot of things you've really been a voice and an advocate for on this podcast and in your life that then you confess like, but I completely struggle with this and I don't do this for myself at all.
Totally. Yeah. It's like something that you kind of try to speak into existence more than anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious about if that teaching was given to you at that young age, what that would have meant for you, allowing people to have the space to process their feelings.
I don't think I would have been able to understand it. I feel like the emotional literacy in my family growing up didn't really feel that high. Like there was certainly intellectual principles and values that I think likely were rooted in an emotional sense of right and wrong and that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. there wasn't really, I don't feel that I was taught like a lot of emotional regulation and really good skills for emotional intimacy with myself and others. So that could have been told to me, but I wouldn't have been able to really understand what that meant really on a feelings level until my adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I had, I mean, would you say that that teaching is about emotional literacy? Because I'm like, I don't know if my mom has ever been, I've never seen her as like the most emotionally literate person. You know what I mean? It's interesting you saying or framing it that way. And I'm curious around, is that what emotional literacy, or an example of having like high emotional literacy?
I think so. It's interesting that you say that because I've never met your mom and I just know about her from what you tell me, obviously. But it surprises me that you haven't thought of her that way. Just, you know, even I think all the time, it's like one of my favorite stories about how your mom would say to you, like, babe, you're so good at telling the truth. What you might want to work on is just sweetening it up a little bit. And I feel like that to me is like such high emotional intelligence because she was able to, first of all, observe you and observe you in relationships and make this observation, approach you with a huge amount of love and care and kind of positive affirmation, and give you this little piece of feedback that I think shows her grasp and, you know, understanding of what it takes to really be able to connect with people and have good relationships.
Mm. Wow. I mean, I really appreciate you saying that. And I feel kind of called out for not seeing my mom the way that, you know, the way that you just described her. Maybe it's because it's always been easier. And I guess it's maybe even like human nature, I don't know, to kind of see our parents as like, you know, maybe we can accept that they're trying their best, but it still feels like it falls short. So when you reminded me of that story, it made me laugh because I really think that she was just tired of me just like whooping her ass verbally and telling her shit about herself. Like, I think that's where it came from, which is she's just like, girl, if you don't shut the fuck up. But she was like, let me not, you know, like totally make this child feel like, because it's a good thing to tell the truth. So I really appreciate you bringing that out.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense that it might have been coming from that. But I think what I would have heard in varying degrees of, you know, how this is expressed depending on
totally
which parent. But I would have heard, don't talk back, don't be disrespectful. Mm. Like they wouldn't have said, you know, shut the fuck up.
Right.
But the message would have been,
yes,
shut up. I think it wouldn't have been like, okay, you're telling me things about myself that maybe I don't like to hear. I would have been like, that's disrespectful. Stop talking back.
Right. Right. Huh. It's your turn. It's your turn. I want to know biggest teaching.
I love how you emphasized it.
Like, I'm trying to make you more stressed pressure. Out about it. Go.
No, not going to be making you comfortable on this. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this today, and you know, so I guess some of the biggest teachers came to my mind. Like you know, like I feel like Oprah raised me in a lot of ways, like many of our generation. You know, my friend Soraya, there's so much that I felt that she's taught me, you know, around spirituality and self-love and healing and creativity. Mal has been a huge teacher in my life, my relationship with them. There's so many big teachers, but when I was trying to think of specific teachings, mm-hmm. I was kind of struggling to think of what have been the kind of the biggest influences. And then I was reading a memoir this morning, and this person who was writing it, she was kind of recounting the beginning, the kind of courtship phase of her eventual marriage, which, you know, spoiler alert, we knew turned out to be horrible in a lot of ways.
Right.
And as I was reading it from very, like, the first interaction, I felt, I see why she went for him, and also huge red flags here.
Mm-hmm.
And what it made me think of is this book called Why Does He Do That? It was written by a white man, and it really demystifies abuse, intimate partner abuse especially, and what are the patterns in it, because there are very clear patterns, because so often, you know, this stuff isn't taught to us, and in actually in a lot of ways abuse is taught to us. And so learning to spot the signs of what is abuse and learning to cut through all of the very intentional kind of confusion and misdirection and all of that of abuse, very, very challenging. But after I read that book, I had been in like nothing but abusive relationships before that, and I was never in one again.
Wow.
And I don't ever, I shouldn't say ever, sometimes it can be very complicated, but I rarely feel confused. And I see all the time Reddit. I feel like so much of what, when I'm scrolling on Reddit, so like 90% of the posts are people being like, I'm really confused about this behavior by my partner. Like, what's going on? And I read it and I'm immediately like, oh, your partner is abusive. It's very obvious. But it's not obvious, you know, to them. That's why so many people are writing about it. But again, this book, it just so demystified everything that it was just a skill set that completely changed the trajectory of my life and relationships. So yeah, the teacher wouldn't have been
your pick of the litter necessarily. Yeah.
And just like when I think of the people who kind of inspire me the most and who have such a profound impact on my identity and how I express myself and all of that, it's totally different than like this particular teacher. Mm-hmm. But the teaching, like, I can't think of anything that has radically like altered the course of my life and kept me safe in the way that did.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it offered you like an opportunity to have clarity, because you just described like the Reddit threads of people being confused and not knowing, and like the ways that like the reality gets shrouded in the misdirections and the other sort of like, but this, but also this, but this, you know, resource, this book that this man wrote was able to like kind of cut through like all of that other bullshit. And I'm wondering, is there or was there something that stuck out to you the most about that book that really maybe changed your thinking about something? Or was it the language that was used or the examples that were used? Or what about it got you in a way that previously maybe you hadn't even come across any resource that was directly speaking about intimate partner abuse? Or
yeah, I hadn't. And you know, this book was written from decades of experience working with abusers, and in particular working in groups with abusers, which is really the most effective, one of the only effective ways to treat abusive people, in particular, like batterers. And in those groups, they would like call each other out. And when it wasn't like directly about them, they were so happy and thrilled to like kind of spill all of the secrets of, you know, what they're doing and like how intentional it really is and how they do, you know, usually sort of know what they're doing or what the, you know, desired effect is. So there were so many parts of it, you know, there were all of like the signs of abuse. There were all like different kind of types, like personality types almost. And abusers can be like, and not that it's like a binary between abuser and victim, but people who are using abusive tactics, it's not necessarily just one or the other. It can be mixes, but it's really helpful to kind of have all these like archetypes almost. There was, you know, how to know if an abuser is changing or not, like if they're really changing, which that I remember like right after I read that book, there was somebody who had been in my life kind of on and off. And I think as I was sort of reading the book, kind of had the courage maybe to name some of the behaviors and sort of call this person out on it. And he admitted some of it and was apologizing. And then I watched, it was literally textbook. I watched, you know, that chapter kind of come to life where it started with, I'm so sorry, you're right. This was assault and et cetera. And then when I wasn't, you know, kind of forgiving him and comfortable with particular, you know, particular intimacies or whatever relationship, you know, moving forward, very quickly then became, well, you're holding a grudge and like, well, why are you like still talking about this? And we've already talked about this. And well, actually, you know, I'm not the only one who's done anything in this relationship. And really, like, you had a lot to do with what happened and all of this kind of thing. And it was, I was like, oh, it's literally textbook.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, I'm going to block you and I'm never going to speak to you again. And that's what I did. I never spoke to that person ever again.
Right.
But yeah, it's like I've seen it happen so many times. I remember when Gian Gomeshi tried to get out ahead of his story and released a statement. And I saw on Facebook, like some of my friends who just didn't have the same education, you know, like people who had great values and, you know, but they, you know, liked the statement. And as soon as I read his statement, I'm like, I have no information other than what he has said. I was like, oh, this guy is very guilty. This is very clear.
Right. Would you say that prior to reading that book, you would have been like left guessing, like truly the, you know, you said that the most profound thing was that it was demystifying. And so I'm wondering around like, how would you have made sense of the behavior? Would you, and you also said something like that this behavior is actually intentional. And it's not as like haphazard or like, oh, he just didn't know. And I'm wondering, like, in your experience before reading this book, would you have thought that it was like this person was like also a victim and like just didn't know what they were doing and all of that?
I probably would have been like, oh, what's happening here? I'm you know, who knows? Like I said, I had been in multiple abusive relationships, so I obviously wasn't able to see the signs, either the warning signs or the actual like being able to see as it's happening, this is abuse. An example that I remember, I read the book a long time ago, but an example that I remember is a woman saying, you know, her husband had been like increasingly jealous, and then he would make kind of accusations and it was sort of increasing. And then one day she was meeting him for lunch on her lunch break. And she came down the elevator and she and a male colleague kind of got out of the elevator at the same time. And then her husband started accusing her of having sex with this other man in the elevator. And she was like,
girl, what?
What is wrong with him? Like, that's, how could he think, like, not only that I would do that, but that that was possible, you know? It's this busy high rise, like, we're dressed, it's the middle of the day, like, that's, like, is there something like mentally wrong with him,
right,
that he believes this? Because it just seems so worrying that he could even think that that was a possibility.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to, you know, this, the husband being in this program and everything, and it was like, no, he of course he knew that that wasn't possible.
Mm-hmm.
But making those kinds of accusations constantly not only keeps her sort of on her toes and never feeling kind of secure or comfortable, which makes her a lot easier to control. But also what had happened is, you know, when that kind of jealousy and those kinds of accusations are like become so commonplace, you have a tendency to start, well, I'm just not going to do this thing. I'm not going to do this thing because I know what that
does to him, quote unquote.
Exactly. Right. And a lot of times people, like, they think... And another example, you know, is sort of the partner who just becomes very, very moody. And, you know, similarly, might think, I'm not being abused or controlled because he didn't tell me I wasn't allowed to do X, Y, and Z thing. I just stopped doing it because I didn't want to have the argument.
Right.
And so things like that, that I think would be really easy to just sort of think, oh, like, he has some kind of mental health issue.
Right.
Or there's maybe something wrong with him, or maybe what am I doing to make him feel this way? And
yeah,
you know, once this all becomes, again, demystified, and the book really laid things out in such a beautifully, like, easy to learn kind of way, it was like, yeah, none of this is confusing, and I don't have to waste all of this time on, like, figuring out, okay, what exactly, where is this coming from, and what, it's like, this is abuse, stop asking questions, it's not supposed to make sense, it doesn't make sense except to understand it as abuse.
Wow. That's got to be, I mean, I'm sure, I guess my question really is like, immediately as you were reading that book, were you feeling like, whoa, 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 this is incredible? Or were you like, why? Like, I just feel like there'd be like so many different emotions that would come up for me if I had been in abusive relationships and I was reading that for the first time, like, that I would feel both like, thank God I have this, now I have this information, and also simultaneously, like you said, we don't really have like open conversations about abuse, but yet like it's so common for people to feel like, to chalk it up to like an individual mental health thing, to chalk it up to like, oh, this is just the way this person is, like a personality trait or something, right? As opposed to something that is like actually proven standard operating procedures for people who are abusive. And so I don't know, like as you were describing, and I mean, obviously you felt like, thank God I have this book, like I will never make these decisions to be with or to try to make sense of this person. I need to make sense that this person is abusive and I can make these different decisions. I feel like if I found that out, I'd also just be like, where the fuck was this? Like, why the fuck don't we have these conversations? Why do we normalize behavior of like, even, you know, jealousy or any of those things? Like, we don't get enough resources and tools about how to be in good relationship in general.
Yeah.
Did that frustration come up for you, or was it like more a sense of like relief? Like, this finally makes sense.
I mean, I think the overwhelming feeling was empowerment, and just, it was very exciting to finally have these tools, and yeah, how just life-changing it was. I will say that it's been very isolating on this side of the teachings, which I think I don't always, I think I've learned to distance myself from a lot of the grief and rage around that, because it's just too painful otherwise. Like, how many people who have been in my life, you know, friends and family who are still in my life in some cases, aren't able or willing to understand this and haven't been, and, you know, would just sort of treat me like I'm wrong, or maybe I'm just like, oh, you're just traumatized, and so you see, you know, abuse where there isn't, or, you know, things like that, because there are definitely still people who I'm connected to, or who I just observe in the world, who are apologists and who tell me these stories, or I hear these stories and I'm just like, come on. No, that's not what's happening here. Like, you're buying into the abuser's narrative. This is clearly not what's happening here. It's so obvious.
Right.
So it is hard being on this side of it. Sometimes it's like much safer, and it's, I wouldn't trade it for anything, but I wish there was more of us on this side.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, because you're right. I don't, you sharing this with us right now is like the first time that I've really spent mentally exploring or listening to somebody talk about like the calculated ways that people enact abuse. And so I would imagine, like, once you have your kind of eyes open to it, when we live in a culture in which people who cause harm can, you know, evade accountability in so many different creative ways, when you're able to see that, like, the harm, like, to see the harm for the depth of what it is, as opposed to like a personality trait or, you know, something like a mood swing or something like that, and you're able to see it in like a grounded, like, almost bigger picture, I can't imagine how much more attuned you would be to like picking up on when things that people might brush away or just say like, oh, it's not a big deal, that it actually is a lot more serious. And I would imagine that also kind of creates like a heightened sense of like concern for when you see certain behaviors acted out, or people talk about things, or you know what I mean? Like that is a lot of a massive burden to hold.
Yeah, it can be. It really does feel that way sometimes, to see something or hear a story or, you know, hear from a friend and just sort of be like,
no,
God, you know, you can try to like name it as much as you can, but you have to really measure what are they ready to hear and all of that.
Right.
So, yeah, it definitely feels very heavy, even though it also kind of feels like a superpower sometimes.
I want to switch gears a little bit and go back to something that you said before around people in your life. And you, I know we spent much of our time just now talking about this sort of like unlikely teacher, you know, but that before that you named, you know, Oprah and Mal and other people in your life that have been like, whose impact, not necessarily like a specific teaching, but have been like really profound on you. I know you love Oprah. So I really want to know about like, what is it about Oprah that is so deeply impactful for you? Or what's something about her? What have you witnessed her do or say? Or is it about her like je ne sais quoi that really gets you going?
It's, I think, her way of approaching life. So she developed this way of approaching life where everything is a teacher. So she felt like sitting on that stage for 25 years or whatever it was, like she treated each guest like a teacher and each experience as a teacher. And it was just that, I think, very conscious way of living life and the sort of spirituality of that, which I also had not really been exposed to spirituality outside of that. And I think that combined with, she also, you know, was this huge breaker of stigma around abuse and violence. Her show, and yeah, I'm sure I saw many, many episodes, it kind of created, it really was a culture shift in terms of speaking about abuse and violence. And you know, when I first was watching her in high school, I wouldn't have been really aware of that. But certainly, like, in my young adulthood and when I was a survivor, that became just so huge. And I think along with that is a sort of embracing of emotionality. So I think all of those things combine to just be a very radically different way of living life and being a person and being in relationship.
Yeah.
But you said that you didn't really watch Oprah, right? You weren't really exposed to her growing up, or
no? I did watch Oprah growing up, but it wasn't. She didn't have like that kind of impact on me. I don't think I watched her enough for that effect to have been on me, if that makes sense. But I definitely remember the times when I would chime in, I'd be like, whoa, Oprah is able to hold space for such like deeply painful conversations, and the way that she looks at people, the way that she listens, like the way that she just shows up and gives like people some space to like grieve in public, even like so that she cries with them. Like, I found that to be so interesting, but I never thought about it until you just described that like unique quality. And the fact that that is like, that was a cultural shift of like what we could have public conversations on, and the range of guests that she would have, from like people who were like a quote unquote A-list celebrities to just like people who've had like a really hard experience or experiences, that she would do all of that. And I never got the sense that it was like, oh, we have like Beyonce on for 25 minutes and this other person on for 5 minutes. Like, she would give people like so much space, which I find really beautiful. But yeah, I wasn't like raised on Oprah. My mom definitely watched it, but I don't think that I connected the dots too much until like meeting you and hearing about like how profoundly impactful Oprah was on you. I was like, you know what, actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. No one else in my family, and I wasn't even allowed to watch Oprah for a long time. And then really? I think I started like sneakily doing it in high school. And eventually I got old enough that people kind of stopped
caring,
trying to police what I was watching as much. But yeah, I mean, even though I'm like sitting here telling you about how profoundly impactful that lesson of treating everything as a teacher was, I mean, I think it's probably one of those things that you have to practice for your whole life. Because I think I still forget to do that. I'm not present enough to always like approach every person in front of me and everything all the time as a teaching. It's easier maybe like with clients. I feel like I'm able to do that. I feel like I learn so much from my clients, but I think there would be much more richness if I was able to bring that to even maybe the more casual or more challenging or different parts of my life. Yeah. I don't know. Does that idea resonate with you? And do you feel like you're able to put it into practice?
Seeing things as
everyone is a teacher. And everything is as a teacher. Yeah.
Maybe some things more easily than others, because remember, my biggest question that I ask myself is, what does it mean that? So I'm always like trying to like make sense of things. And sometimes it's like, you don't have the why. So you throw the why out there and cast a wide net, and you're just like, it's all of these things when it might not be any of them. So I'm careful with that. I'm careful with trying to like make the most sense out of things. But that being said, do I find myself looking back at situations and being like, that was a lesson, like that was an opportunity for me to like learn how to show up for myself, or like that was an opportunity, like retrospectively in real time. Mm-hmm. So much more difficult. I don't think I'm mm-hmm. there yet at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard. But yeah, I remember, you know, her sort of saying, if you're in a bad relationship, you're a student of being in a bad relationship right now. Or if you're in a dead end job, you're a student of being in a dead end job right now, or just anything. And yeah, it is often really hard to put into practice. But I do find it's so stabilizing in a way when I am able to, even maybe if I'm greatly suffering, to be able to take that step back. It kind of helps you go more into that observer mm-hmm. role, mm-hmm. right? And that's a way more kind of grounded place. You're not like fully in
the eye of the storm. The
yeah
totally, absolutely, that makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate that. I'm sort of like, how do you shift your own, I don't know, position in the thing that you're experiencing to give yourself a little more room, give yourself a little bit more grounding.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to close with the last teaching that's been impactful for me. For my mom, again, mommy dearest, I will have to send her this episode. I do not believe she's listened to any episodes because she can't figure out the podcasts. But the last, or the one of the important teachings that she's imparted to all of my sisters is, you always leave something better than the way that you found it. I know that this is not a uniquely Milka teaching. But yeah, like that teaching has made me try to be more aware. That coupled with the, you know, you're great at telling the truth, but try to sweeten it up a little bit. It's shifted how I see myself as somebody that can bring goodness into spaces, and somebody that is, because it's hard to see that sometimes. In and of ourselves, it's hard to like see and accept and believe that our presence can be a value add, especially when you've internalized that your presence is not a value add, or that it's, you know, could be disruptive or anything else like that. So yeah, just the fact that, you know, she chose a profession where, you know, she might go onto her like ward or the floor that she's working on as a nurse, and her thing is always like, I love working with these people because, you know, we just giggle, we like try to make life a little bit sweeter, we try to make it a little bit easier and a little more fun. Like, that is her energy going into nursing, which I think is hilarious because, you know, that lady is wild sometimes. And I'm like, I can't imagine. She works with a bunch of like senior citizens. She's like, most of them are senile. You bet your bottom dollar that we are making fun of anything and any, like, they just have no sweet clue. And she's like, it's fun. We make it fun. And so, yeah, bringing that sweetness, or bringing that sense of like, how can I show up here? Not with the like, people are expecting me, because then it becomes like you are imparting so much emotional labor to like meet the standards of other people. But like, when you find it within yourself to see the sweetness that you have to bring, or the joy, or like the care, or whatever, that you can like make something a little bit better, even if it's incrementally, it's like pretty powerful, because then you, I don't know, really start to like know your own worth.
Yeah, that feels so empowering, and like such an incredible connection that we're able to have to the sweet things in life and to goodness, you know, that like with all of, you know, the shit in the world and the things that we go through as well, that we still sort of have this power, this ability to bring goodness or bring sweetness into spaces and relationships and wherever we go. That does, it feels really life affirming to me.
Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community, and we cannot do this without you.